Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, Minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sabbatarian Congregation, Mount Sinai at the 12th Hour in the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is May 18, 2014, or the 5th, 2018. We will start our second service on this first day of the week with a song entitled, Sound the Battle Cry. Sound the battle cry, see the foe is not. Raise their standard high for the young. Gird your armor on, stand firm, everyone. Rest your cause upon His holy word. Thousand soldiers rally round the banner, ready, steady, pass the word along. Onward, forward, shout aloud, Hosanna! Joshua is captain of the mighty throng. Strong to meet the foe, marching on we go, while our cause we know must prevail. Shield and banner bright, gleaming in the light, battling for the right, ne'er can fail. Russian soldiers rally round the banner, ready, steady, pass the word along. Onward, forward, shout aloud, Hosanna, Joshua is captain of the mighty throng. O thou Yahweh, hear us when we call, help us one and all by thy grace. When the battle's done and the victory's won, may we wear the crown before thy face. Rousing soldier, rally round the banner, ready, steady, pass the word along. Onward, forward, shout aloud, Hosanna! Joshua is captain of the mighty throng. Men on the White Horse, we're going to continue on now with our second track that Ben Roden rewrote from V.T. Hotoff at the 11th hour. This is track number 16. This is a track V.T. Hotoff wrote before he died, but it didn't get published in the Rod book, so Ben Roden published it in 1968, with his added thoughts, and unfolding of the scroll on this here truth. So we're going to continue to call it Man on the White Horse, since it's Ben Roden, and this is his work. But we're in the track, like I say, at the 11th hour. Judgment of the Living is actually the title of it. And at the 11th hour means, in the 12th hour, means the message that came at the end of the 11th hour. Okay, so this is a message intended for the 12th hour. We're starting on page 12. We're going to be just a little review from our last study. This says, the leopard-like beast having seven heads and 10 crown horns, with the body of a leopard, the feet of a bear, and the mouth of a lion, is as clear a symbolization as inspiration can make it, that it is a composite beast of Daniel's four beasts, which is your fourth beast, pagan Rome, which is a composite of Daniel's four beasts, so Babylon, which is represented by the lion, the bear, Medo-Persia, the leopard is Grecia, and the nondescript beast with the ten horns, Rome, pagan Rome, imperial Rome, at the cross, that's found in Daniel 7. And keep in mind now, this leopard-like beast with the ten crown horns, run contemporaneously with the fourth beast, the pagan Rome during the Dark Ages from 538 to 1798, and it run contemporaneously with the second phase of that fourth beast of Daniel, which was ecclesiastical Rome, which was the papacy during the Dark Ages. The beast succeeded that second phase of pagan Rome in 1798. That's when he came up out of the sea. Okay?
And so he's recognized then as the fifth beast. The little two-horned beast in Revelation 13 represents the United States government, the little lamb-like beast, so that's your number six beast. And then the scarlet-colored beast, that the image is of the fifth beast, found in Revelation 17 with the mystery Babylon, the woman riding the beast and guiding and ruling the beast. The beast represents the papacy. The woman riding represents the ruler over mystery Babylon, and that is your Muslim world. Now, Obama is this woman, and that's your Muslim world that's ruling over the beast. But keep in mind that that's only temporary. She only rules for a while until those ten horns represents all your communist nations of the world that are lend their power to the beast exclusively, which is the papacy. They turn on the woman and eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Okay. And they turn on that two-horned beast, the United States government. That's where the woman has her headquarters at Washington, D.C. And the little two-horned beast represents our government at Washington, D.C. And the woman, Mystery Babylon, is ruling from our government at the White House in Washington, D.C. And in Revelation 19 says, when it's all over with, she's judged, and it says, the beast and the false prophet, the little two-horned beast, with that false prophet Obama, representing that woman, Mystery Babylon, Revelation 17, and those that they had deceived and taken the mark of the beast, Revelation 19:20, are both taken and cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone, and that is your type of the lake of fire at the end of the millennium. So all of those that are destroyed in this lake of fire, they don't come up in the second resurrection at the end of the millennium to die in the second lake of fire, because they are a type. Okay, so he says, by this a composite symbolization is revealed. The fact that the leopard-like beast is a descendant of Daniel's four beasts and is therefore the melting pot of the ancient nations in general and the symbol of the world of today in particular. Logically so too, because all the nations of the past as well as of the present, both dead and living, must necessarily come before the throne of the judgment. They are therefore for this cause all embodied in this beast symbolism. The ten crownless horns of Daniel's fourth beast, moreover, being symbolical of the king that were to arise from the disintegration of the Roman Empire, Revelation 17:12, the contrast with the ten crown horns of John's leopard-like beast, Revelation 13:1, prove that the latter beast is in the particular the symbol of the world after the fall of pagan Rome. This is seen from the fact that the envisioned kings were first symbolized in Daniel's fourth beast as crownless horns, showing that they had not taken their kingdom as yet, and last in John's first beast as crown horns, showing that they had finally taken their kingdom, the scarlet-colored beast driven by a woman, church, with his crownless horns, though this seemed to represent a third period, a crownless period, a governmental condition similar to that of the ecclesiastical Rome's, a combination of church and state rule. Unmistakably, this last beast is a symbol of the world of tomorrow. That's your scarlet-colored beast, Revelation 17. This beast's crownless horns then positively reveal that the aforementioned crowned kings, which arose from the ruins of the Roman Empire and which have descended down unto our day, as symbolized by the crown horns of the leopard-like beast, are to be dethroned and superseded by crownless kings, by presidents, premier, and the like. For that is what the crownless horns of the scarlet-colored beast denote. The next world ruler, though, is to be the great whore, Babylon, a counterfeit religious system. For she is the one who rides, rules the beast. The crownless set of rulers, represented by the horns, giving their power to the beast. That's the scarlet colored beast. That's the image to that fifth beast, the leopard-like beast that represented pagan and ecclesiastical Rome. It came to its end in 1798, and it came up out of the sea in 1798, succeeding ecclesiastical Rome. While the whore reigns and rides the beast, is again confirming the fact that the church is to rule the world with the consent of its civil authorities. This they do, not by their own will, but because Elohim hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of the Yahweh shall be fulfilled. Revelation 17:17. They nevertheless will in time make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. Verse 16. Since these crownless horns hate the woman, religion, they obviously represent such rulers as in communism. They will make war with the Lamb, but the Lamb shall overcome them. Verse 14. He makes war with them rather than with others because they rule the world at that time, because they are the ones with whom men reign ceases. World religious system. Now the fact that the crown kings are already fast disappearing, are practically all dethroned, is proof positive that the world is about to shape up its next and final aspect in the drama of sin and penitence. Thus, the crown world policy, the one represented by the leopard-like beast, is about to pass away eternally. And a crownless one, dominated by an international religious system as depicted in the scarlet-colored beast, is to be ushered in. So when did the leopard-like beast then with the ten horns of the crowns on come to an end? At the end of the 11th hour. We're going to learn that as we continue to read this message. At the end of the 11th hour in 2002. And the scarlet-colored beast was ushered in at that time. And the little two-horned beast is the one that brought the leopard-like beast to its end at the end of the 11th hour. And the little two-horned beast is the one that's in power, our United States government, that ushered in the scarlet-colored beast and got it prepared and created that beast during the time that the Republicans were running the White House with the George Bushes from 2001 to 2009. And that's whenever they created that image to the beast, the scarlet-colored beast, and then they handed the keys to Obama, the woman that stood up on and commanded that beast from that point on, from 2009 on. This is where we now stand in the prophetic history of the world, and this is why the world is now so upset, in fear and confusion, in a state of the being as when a tree is shaken by a mighty wind. No need to fear communism, since the crown kings, or crown horns, are a thing of the past, and since the crownless communistic-like rulers, the ones that hate the woman, hate religion, who rise, rules the beast, are to give their kingdom unto the beast, there is no need for fear that communism is now to take over and stay on top. Although the crownless horns agree and give their power and strength unto the beast while the woman reigns over the nation, yet after one symbolical hour they take up their power and, as previously pointed out, make the woman desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. Revelation 17:16. So, though communism seems to be next in line, the idea of it having absolute power of the world before the woman does seems impossible, even though it may take still deeper root than it already has. For the ten crownless horns on the scarlet-colored beast, Revelation 17, nevertheless, are to rule the world at last. And they represent the communist nations. But they have to destroy the woman first. And that woman represents Allah and the Muslim religion. So it shows you right there that all the Muslims, the terrorist radicals, are going to be destroyed when that woman is destroyed. But not before they unseat the woman, as seen in verse 16. Accordingly, in this symbolization is seen that there is a definite governmental dissimilarity between the period represented by the leopard-like beast and the period represented by the scarlet-colored beast, and that is, the former is ruled by the crown king's horns, but the latter is not. Also, as previously shown, the multiplex composition of the leopard-like beast points out that in it is wrapped, symbolized both the world of yesterday and the world of today, all the dead and the living to the present, as long as it remains to be the symbol of the world. Whereas in the scarlet-colored beast is wrapped only the world of tomorrow. Okay. So now the world of tomorrow, represented by the scarlet-colored beast, had its beginning in 2002, at the beginning of the 12th hour and the judgment of the living. And it said, and all the dead and the living of tomorrow. So the scarlet-colored beast is wrapped only in the world of tomorrow, with all of the dead and all of the living of tomorrow. Beginning at the judgment of the living 2002, all these facts cause two things to stand out clearly, that with the culmination of the former beast period, the judgment of the dead ceases, and that the former beast was your leopard-like beast, come up out of the sea, Revelation 13, with the composite of Daniel's four beasts, and with the 10 crown horns, showing that all the nations in and the kings had taken their kingdoms before they lost their and then they lose their crowns whenever the scarlet-colored beast comes and takes its place, and that was in 2002. And with the ascendancy, all these facts cause two things to stand out clearly: that with the culmination of the leopard-like former beast period, the judgment of the dead ceases. And the judgment of the dead ceased in 2002. And with the ascendancy of the and descendancy of the latter beast, the judgment of the living world begins and ends. Okay, so now, with the ascendancy of this the scarlet-colored beast, Revelation 17, and the descendancy of the latter beast, the judgment of the living world begins and ends. So this leopard-like beast, scarlet-colored beast, she has a beginning and an ending, before probation closes here in the 12th hour. So we got a lot to take place, folks, in this 12th hour. We got the judgment of the living of the righteous to be sealed first and sealed in and sheltered in. For the revelation, furthermore, makes clear that the two horned beast represents a high-ranking government, one having the power to perform wonders, to even reshape the governmental principles of the nation, and to bring them down to the level of the world that is represented by the leopard-like beast in his pre-wounded state, that's during the Dark Ages, the papacy, to the level of church-state rule. Now, what does this tell us? When the government sets up a church-state rule again, like they did during the Dark Ages, that means that that's going to be running counter to Yahweh setting up his church-state rule with his governmental kingdom of the house of David ruling. Okay? So, at the time that Yahweh brings forth his one-world order with the everlasting kingdom of David set up, that's the same time that the scarlet-colored beast brings her new world order of church and state rule. For the condition in which the beast blasphemed Elohim's name, his tabernacle, what tabernacle? The tabernacle of David, and them that dwell in heaven as well, Revelation 13:6. For inspiration so indicates in the words, and he doeth great wonders so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying unto them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he caused all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, and that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Revelation 13:13-17. But thank the Yahweh, he will have his people securely inside of the kingdom, his kingdom. And they represent the seven, the beast and all those that they have deceived represents the 666. And the 666 cannot get at the ones that are covered by the 777. And that's Yahweh's saints in his kingdom. And you can go to Isaiah chapter 4, and you can get a prophecy on that, where it says that there is a canopy put over the top of Yahweh's saints, over every dwelling place and inhabitant of the kingdom. They're going to have a shelter. They're going to have a wall of fire round about them, and so forth. Let's continue on. Thus the two-horned beast, representing the United States government, is to decree that anyone who fails to comply with his demand of the worship should be killed. Well, Obama is running this here government of the two-horned beast right now. At the same time, while he's sitting on the beast of Mr. Babylon and riding that beast and ruling that beast. This will come to pass while the woman rides the beast. Through this symbolical prophecy, is also seen that in an effort to perhaps clamp down on communism and to save the world system of religion, the churches will consolidate themselves and set up a world government, with the church being its brains and the state its power. For the beast number, though, being in sixes, 666, not in the biblical sevens, which denotes completeness, or all, shows an omission of a part of the world from its system of worship. That is, some of the sects will refuse to comply with the beast decree. If none other, it is certain that the remnant who keep the commandments of Yahweh and have the testimony of the Yahshua with the spirit of prophecy in their midst will stay out of it. And this is the very thing that will cause the beast to rigidly enforce its demand. And you will find that Bible reference in Revelation chapter 12:17. It is also interesting to note that the two-horned beast develops a super career during the end of the period that is represented by the leopard-like beast. Okay, the period that the leopard-like beast ended with was in 2002 at the closing of the 11th hour and the judgment of the dead. And rest, and this here little two-horned beast rest its career during the end of the period that is represented by the scarlet-colored beast. So this little two-horned beast started exercising his power in 1776 when we had our Revolutionary War. The colonies had their Revolutionary War and won their independence from Great Britain. And that's set up the leopard-like beast's rule as well. And that leopard-like beast continued on through the two-horned beast, representing our government, and the two-horned beast made an image of the scarlet-colored beast, and so therefore this beast represented in three phases, starting in 1776 and goes on to the end of Prohibition. Thus the world of today, with the world of yesterday and the world of tomorrow, are all seen to stand before the judicial throne of the Elohim. For this truth is again seen from the fact that chapter 14, the next after chapter 13, brings to view the two harvests, the first and second fruits, the living members of the church, judgment of the living members of the church. After these events, chapter 15 unfolds those things which close this particular phase of the judgment, for there it is stated, and after that I looked, and behold, the temple of the tabernacle of the testimony in heaven was opened, and the seven angels came out of the temple, having the seven plagues, clothed in the pure and white linen, and having their breasts girded with the golden girdle. And one of the four beasts gave unto the seven angels seven golden vials full of the wrath of the Elohim, who liveth forever and ever. And the temple was filled with the smoke from the glory of the Elohim and from his power. And no man was able to enter into the temple till the seven plagues of the seven angels were fulfilled. Revelation 15:5-8. Simply put, after the seventh angel with the seventh trumpet sounded, He went in, but when he came out, he shouted and said, it's all over with. The judgment for the living is ended. And now for the living that are living, and also for the resurrected, those that are resurrected. And now it is time to probation to close and the plagues to fall upon the wicked. Now it's time to destroy all the wicked. For the sanctuary which Moses was commanded to build was patterned after the temple in heaven. Exodus 25:9-40. And by looking into the earthly, we see the heavenly that is according unto Moses. Record the sanctuary consisted of the two main apartments, the holy and the most holy. Exodus 26:33. On the day of the atonement, the day of the typical judgment, the veil of the most holy was pulled aside, open, and the door of the holy was closed, throwing the two apartments into one. But after the atonement was over, the door of the sanctuary, the holy, was open, and the door of the veil into the most holy was closed. From this is seen what the inspiration means when it says, the temple was open, and the seven angels, and also the four beasts, who are symbolical of the redeemed host, Revelation 5:8-9, came out of it, all of which indicates that the premillennial session of the judgment atonement will then be over, that no man from then on can enter in the temple until after the plagues are poured out. Thus, after the judgment, come the seven last plagues, chapter 16. Having described the inspection of the guest with the living members of the church in the house of the Yahweh, as well as subsequent results that befall the wicked multitude, for the inspiration in the chapter 18 takes us the final phase of the judgment, as the judgment of the Babylon and her dominion, with the last world symbol, the woman riding the scarlet colored beast. Chapter 19 discloses the fact that the government of the heaven is then to war with the governments of the earth. They will be defeated and the whole world come to an end. In other words, the whole world comes to an end for the wicked, because it doesn't come to an end for the righteous. Indeed, every unrepentant sinner will at last, for the mercy's sake, be put to death, and every saint, for the glory's sake, be left to live forever. Thereby the world will pass away and the church eternal take over. For says the inspiration, and the beast is taken, and with him the false prophet that wrought miracles before him, with which he deceived them that had received the mark of the beast, and them that worshipped his image. These both were cast alive into a lake of the fire burning with the brimstone, and the remnant were slain with the sword of him that sat upon the horse, which sword proceeded out of his mouth, and all the fowls were filled with their flesh. Revelation 19:20-21. Here we have it as clear as it can be made that first the beast and the prophet, then the remnant. The beast and the prophet are two individuals. The remnant are the rest of the world's multitudes. The millennial judgment. This is our next subject. After this commences the millennial judgment of the dead world, as shown in the next chapter. And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them, and I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Yahshua and for the word of Elohim, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, now they had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Yahshua 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead lived not again until 1,000 years are finished. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy is he that hath part in the first resurrection. On such a second death hath no power. But they shall be priests of the Elohim and of the Yahshua, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Revelation 20:4-6. Here is seen how the world comes to its end and how the millennium begins. Notwithstanding this, even the earth itself is dissolved, for the revelation continues. And the heaven departed the scroll when it is rolled together, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. Revelation 6:14, 20:11. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea, Revelation 21:1. Now the question arises, where do the saints live while the earth is in desolation and before it is made new? Here is the answer. They shall be priests of the Yahweh and of Yahshua, and shall reign with him 1,000 years, Revelation 20:3. Following the millennium, the holy city comes down with the saints, and then rather than they living with Yahshua, he lives with them. For again says the Revelation, and I heard a great voice out of the heavens saying, behold, the tabernacle of Elohim is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and Elohim himself shall be with them and be their Elohim. Revelation 21:3. Let's read that again. And I heard a great voice out of the heavens saying, behold, the tabernacle of the Yahweh is with men, and the tabernacle of the Yahshua, the Son, is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. And Yahshua himself shall be with them and be their Elohim, Revelation 21:3. Now, why am I using Yahweh and Elohim interchangeably with Yahshua? Because Yahweh and Yahshua are co-creators of the human family. They are the co-creators of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. So when Yahshua shed his blood for those that are the seed of Abraham in our day, those that were the seed of Seth, the third son of Adam, the progenitor of the righteous line clear down to our day, that's the one that Yahshua was co-creator of. These were his people as well as the father's. So therefore, when he shed his blood for them to redeem them and save them, that's when he could rightly say, these are my people, because he was the one that was co-creator of them. Thus, continuing chapter 20, sets forth the imprisonment and punishment of the Satan, the first and the second resurrection, the executive judgment of all the wicked, the millennium, and the final eternal end of the Satan and all his hosts, the second death. In chapter 21, we are told that there is to be a new heaven and a new earth, because the present heaven and earth pass away, Revelation 6:14 and 20:11, and are not existent during the millennium. Chapter 22 gives a description of the New Jerusalem and its coming down from heaven, for the description of the river of the life and also of the tree of the life. Note track number 5, the final warning, as aforementioned, contains a detailed study on the seven trumpets. Chapters 12, 13, and 17, and 18 are further treated in track number 12, The World Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, and detailed exposition of the seven seals is found in track number 15 to the seven churches. These were all sent free of charge to anyone who writes in for them. Okay, let's continue now with track 16, part 2. This is at the 11th hour, Judgment of the Living by the V.T. Harlef, redone by Ben Roden in 1968. He revised it somewhat, I suppose. And so we're going to continue on with Revelation 14 now. This is Volume 2, the revision. As a complete exposition of Revelation 13 is found in track number 12. We come now to a study of Revelation 14, verse 1. And I looked, and lo, a Lamb stood on the Mount Sinai, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their forehead. Mount Sinai, where anciently stood the throne of the King David, was known unto all the prophets as the famous palace site of the kings of Israel, as the chosen mount of the Yahweh's earthly throne. So it is that there is, with the Lamb, the Revelator prophetically saw the first fruits of the harvest, for the fruits denote harvest. The 144,000, the first to be separated from the tares, the first to be redeemed from the bonds of sin, and from among sinners, and also from the yoke of the Gentile. For the judgment harvest of the Elohim, you recall, begins in the house of the Elohim, the church, and it ends the first fruits. It ends with the first fruits from among the 12 tribes of the Israel, Revelation 7:4-8, and Revelation 14:4. For the time is come that the judgment must begin at the house of Yahweh, and should first begin at us, which shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of the Yahweh, 1 Peter 4:17. After this comes the harvest in the Babylon, but conditions are reversed. That is, while the separation in the church is caused by the setting a mark on the faithful, and by the disposing of the abomination-loving multitude from their midst, Ezekiel 9, putting to shame and casting out the bad fish from among the good, Matthew 13:47-50. For the separation in the Babylon is made by a voice from the heaven, saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues, Revelation 18:4. For the second fruits you see come out of all nations that are at that time ruled by the Babylon, the great. For they come in a place where there is no sin and no fear of the plagues hurting them. The 144,000 stand on the Mount Zion, consequently terminated the time of the Gentiles. There, Luke 21:24. And with these godless servants of the Elohim, the church, purified, commences the ingathering of the second fruits from among the Gentile nations, as a result of which is with a great multitude from all nations, Revelation 7:9. For as the first fruits are from the tribes of Israel only, the church. This long-foreseen episode is very significant of the first step toward the reestablishment of the David throne and the fulfillment of the prophecies of the Daniel 2:44, Hosea 1:11, Hosea 3:5, Micah 4:1-5, Isaiah 2:1-4, Jeremiah 32:37-40, Ezekiel 36:24-36, Ezekiel 37:16-28. This, in fact, is the church purified, the house of David, that is, in the 12th hour, judgment of the living time, harvest time of the earth's history, cleansed with the wheat separated from the tares, and the good fish from the bad, and being clothed with the wedding garment from those that are without the wedding garment. For the lamb indicates probationary time, with the term a lamb is applicable unto the Yahshua, for he has many titles, as Yahshua, Yahshua, this year Messiah is a title. Yahshua is his name. The lamb is a title. He has many titles, each of which designates the particular duties of his office at the time, and the event inspiration takes occasion for the unfolding of the scroll, for his title in this instance being as the Lamb very obviously unveils the truth that about the 144,000 that they are standing with him on in the Holy Land during a time in which the blood of the Lamb is still atoning for the penitent human beings, else his title would not be Lamb, but rather as the Lion of the tribe of Judah, or some other, if it is to have a timely significance. For the 144,000 then must stand with him on the Mount Zion during the probationary time in the 12th parabolic hour. It indeed must be so, for they are the first fruits only, implying that there is a second fruit to follow, else the title of first fruits would be a vain and confusing thing, foreign unto the inspiration. Verse 2 and 3, and I heard a voice from the heaven, this is Revelation 14 now, as a voice of many waters, and as a voice of a great thunder, and I heard the voice of the harpers harping with their harps, and they sung as it were a new song before the throne, and before the four beasts, and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 and 4,000 which were redeemed from the earth. Here it is pointed out that the first fruits, the 144,000 descendants of Jacob, in the particular, are to have an experience which the second fruits, the great multitude that comes out of all nations, Revelation 7-9, cannot possibly have. They cannot learn the song at the time that the harpers sing the song. For the 144,000 only can learn that song, says the scriptures. For the second fruits were not there as yet. For these again prove that the first fruits come first, and that all these take place in the end of the world and the time of the harvest, when the tares and the wheat are being separated one from the other. For this work is indeed the cleansing of the sanctuary among the living members of it. Verse 4. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto Elohim and unto the Lamb. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. They follow him as the truth progresses. That is, they followed him as the truth progresses while his work in the sanctuary for the judgment of the dead. And they followed him to the judgment of the living, and thus with him unto Mount Zion. For the Jews, too, could have thus followed if they had not stopped with the truth of the earthly sanctuary, and if they had gone with the truth when it was shown unto them that the services from the earthly were transferred into the heavenly sanctuary, Yahshua himself being the high priest after the order of the Melchizedek, Hebrews 7:11. For the statement, not defiled with women, for they are virgins, very obviously points out that they are found in the church, not in the dominion of the Babylon, the great, and not in the company of her daughters. By the statement, first fruits, moreover, also by the statement that they are from the 12 tribes of Israel, Revelation 7:48, imply that the second fruits, which come from all nations, are not virgins. That they are brought out of the Babylon of the great, while she rides the beast, while she rules the world. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies, Revelation 18:3. If the 144,000 as described in Revelation 7, verses 4-8, come from among the first fruits, then follows logically and biblically that the great multitude of verse 9, who are brought to view immediately after the sealing of the first fruits, are consequently the second fruits. Furthermore, since the 144,000 are strictly from the descendants of the Jacob, and the great multitude strictly from all nations, the facts stand out as high as the mountains that the first fruits are the wheat from the church, and the second fruits the wheat from the world. Well, the second fruits are not depicted by wheat. This is a mistake that Ben Roden made here, because the second fruits are depicted by the fruit of the vine in the fall. You have your first fruit harvest, your wheat harvest in the summertime, representing the 144,000, the remnant of Israel. You have the grape harvest, the fruit harvest of the vine, the clusters of the grape, in the fall. That's for your second harvest. So he says, and the second fruits, the grape harvest from the world. And you go to Revelation 14 and read about that harvest. It says the clusters of the vine are gathered after the wheat is gathered. Gathered during the time the earth is lightened with the glory of the angel, Revelation 18:1. Verse 5, and in their mouth is found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of the Yahweh. As servants of the Elohim, the 144,000 speak nothing but the truth, and so their proclamation of the gospel inspiration insists it is to be accepted as the very word of the Elohim. And verse 6, and I saw another angel fly in the midst of the heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth and unto every nation and kindred and tongue and people. Loud cry message to all nations. Now we're going to go into that. So our next subtitle subject is loud cry message unto all nations for this angel as the angels of the seven churches, chapter 2 and 3. Is symbolical of the ministry as the servants of the Elohim, and since his message, the everlasting gospel, is finally proclaimed unto all nations, while the 144,000 stand with the Lamb on the Mount Zion, it is self-evident that the 144,000 godless servants of the Elohim, the ministers, during the ingathering of the second fruits, proclaim the everlasting gospel, the last unto all nations, that these 11th hour servants finish their work on earth. Now, see, he's saying that the 144,000 are your 11th hour servants. No, they're not. They're your 12th hour servants. And they are that fifth group of laborers in Matthew 20, verse 6, that are called at the 11th hour. Meaning when the 11th hour struck 11, it means that the 11th hour was over, announcing the 12th hour. And that's when they were called, at the end of the 11th hour. For this message, the message of the everlasting gospel. What's the everlasting gospel? The blood of the everlasting covenant of the Yahshua. When considered with the message of chapter 10, which proclaims that there should be time no longer, and that in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of the Elohim should be finished. Revelation 10, 6 and 7. Then it is seen that the former, the everlasting gospel, chapter 14, 6, is proclaimed the second time, first unto many nations, and the second unto all nations. This information is obtained by the reading of chapter 10, 5-11. And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth, land and sea, denotes worldwide, lifted up his hand unto heaven and swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created the heaven and the things that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer, that the end is come. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of the Elohim should be finished, as he hath declared unto his servants the prophets. And the voice which I heard from the heavens spake unto me again, and said, go and take the little book that is open in the hand of the angel that standeth upon the sea and upon the earth. And I went unto the angel, and said unto him, give me the little book. And he said unto me, take it, and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter, but it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey. That is, at first it shall be unto you very sweet and pleasing, but at last very bitter and disappointing. And I took the little book out of the angel's hand, and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey. And as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter. And he said unto me, thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. This sweet and bitter experience has been understood and taught for years by the denomination, for they teach that it was experienced by the First Day Adventist prior on unto and in 1844, that they thought of having come to the end of the world unto the time of the going into the glory. Was a very sweet thought unto them, but having misunderstood the exact event that was to take place in the year of 1844, that it was not the second coming of Yeshua, not the time to take them to glory land, they were bitterly disappointed, exactly as forecast by this sweet, bitter experience. Our next subtitle is the command under the third angel during the judgment of the dead, and the command under the loud cry angel during the judgment of the living. Now let's reread that again with a different preposition. For the command with the third angel, judgment of the dead, and with the command under, or with the loud cry angel, in the judgment of the living. For it has also been understood and taught by the denomination that the command, thou must prophesy again, is a commission unto the Seventh-day Adventists after the disappointment. For the thing that the denomination has failed to note is with the fact that their commission for the prophesying again, that is to teach, it's not before all people, nations, tongues, and kings, but before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings, is showing that the denomination in her present setup is not to finish the gospel work, not to teach all nations, but many. Only a large part of them, whereas the everlasting gospel is proclaimed unto every nation and kindred and tongue and people, Revelation 14:6. Now, I have a comment to make here. The Adventist Church didn't have the commission to teach the everlasting gospel. They never did have that commission. Even though that was the first angels of the three angels that was given to them, was the hour of His judgment has come. Revelation 14:6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel, and to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation, kindred, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear Elohim, and give glory unto him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of water. And there followed another angel, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if any man worship the beast in his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of the Elohim, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Now I just read you the three angels' messages. Now, there's two more angels in this chapter, which is your fourth and your fifth angel. And you'll find that in verses 14, 15, through 20. You'll find those two angels. All right, but I want to deal with this this first angel here. He's saying, he just said, I saw another angel. He didn't say, I saw a first angel. He just said, I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel. Now, translated into the true meaning of what the gospel represents, it represents faith in the blood of the Yeshua. That's what the everlasting gospel encompasses. That's what the commission is for those that are in the, makes it to the 12th hour, and when you make it into the 12th parabolic hour, you come to the first judgment to get there, then you enter into eternal life, or potentially you have entered into eternal life. You can still lose out, but you can also be a guaranteed and promised eternal life if you follow on the advancing rays of truth as they unfold unto you. Then you have eternal life. All right, now it says, but when the Adventist, when William Miller had his disappointment of the First Day Adventist in 1844, when Yahshua didn't come, as William Miller had prophesied for 10 years, to take the waiting saints to heaven, then there was a great disappointment there. So the Adventist, the Seventh Day Adventist, being a continuation of the First Day Adventist, part of them, part of their ongoing movement. William Miller represented the third group with his movement at the sixth hour, at the closing of the sixth hour, and Ellen G. White represented her movement at the closing of the ninth hour of the Seventh-day Adventist. Okay, so now it says in Revelation 10:11 that, and he said unto me that I must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. So what did William Miller prophesy? He prophesied the second coming of Yahshua and the cleansing of the sanctuary. That's what he prophesied. That Yahshua is going to come, burn the earth up with the fire that would constitute the cleansing of the sanctuary and take all the waiting saints to heaven. Okay, so now I said the Seventh-day Adventists would repeat that message. And that's all. They would repeat about the second coming of Yahshua and the cleansing of the sanctuary and the restoration of the sanctuary. That's all they were supposed to teach. They weren't supposed to teach the blood of the everlasting covenant, which is the gospel. That's given to the everlasting kingdom of David in the 12th hour. Adventists only had the commission to preach the second coming of Yahshua in our time, and the cleansing of the sanctuary, and the restoration of the sanctuary. That's all they're supposed to teach with the three angels' message. And that's all they were given to teach from 1844 clear up to 2002. And how many servants were called to represent the leadership of the Adventist Church during that time, during the three steps of the genuine movement of Seventh-day Adventist? They had four of them: Ellen G. White, V.T. Hollis, Ben Roden, and Rhodes W. Johnson. We'll take up the continuation of this study in our next study, and we're going to now close this service with a song. The Old Rugged Cross. On the hill far away stood an old rugged cross, the emblem of suffering and shame. And I love that old cross with the dearest and best a world of loss and has was slain. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange it someday for a crown. Oh, the old rugged cross, so despised by the world, has a wondrous attraction for me. For the dear Lamb of Yah left his glory above to bear it to God's glory. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange
exchange someday for a crown. In the old rugged cross, stained with blood, so divine, of wondrous beauty I see. For 'twas on that old cross Yes, we suffered and died to pardon and sanctify me. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange it someday for a crown. The old rugged crown never ever be true, his shame and reproach gladly bear. Then you'll call me someday to my home far away, where his glory forever I'll share. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the old rugged cross and exchange it someday for a crown.